near. Mud. My sister looked at me quickly, and I realized my tone had altered. Her name was wrapped in my worry. I shook my head. No problem, just, well, did you bleed at any time when you were near the tree? Mud's eyes went wide and fearful. Did I kill Rex? No, sweetheart. But, well, the vampire tree got the way it is because I bled on its roots. And if you bled near it, and it sensed your blood, and we're sisters, well, it might have tried to protect you from the puppy. Mud scowled, and I had a feeling that it looked a lot like my own scowl. I cut myself, she said, holding up her left hand. I slid a potato peeler on my thumb. It was leaking through the bandage. I took her hand and turned it to the light. The wound was still leaking. The commercial-style pale beige bandage was red all along the central pad portion. I did it yesterday. It was still drippy when I left the house to go to devotionals. And did you pass by the tree? Mud held the thumb up and studied it. Yep. She pushed me away and scooted into the couch corner. That was before I became a woman grown. We fell silent, thinking about blood and being grown women and the strange tree. Urine and water's boiling, Mud said. I want real tea, not some yucky herbal stuff. Mama Carmel done been making me drink some awful stuff on account of me being grown up. I remembered Mama Carmel's feminine soother concoctions from my own days in the Nicholson household. They had been pretty awful. How about something with lemon and ginger? And then you and tell me about what we are. More than you done told me last time we talked. Of course, I'm thinking we and you and me, we ain't human. With those words ringing in my ears, I made tea with lemon and ginger and a handful of raspberry leaf, brought the pot in a tea cozy on a tray with mugs, honey, cream and spoons, to the low coffee table in front of the couch. I poured two mugs of the lemon honey tea and mixed my own, leaving Mud's untouched. In the church compound, a woman grown made her own tea. She was a child no longer. Mud stared at me, the pot, the mug, and I watched realization dawn in her eyes. Slowly she leaned forward and added a small splash of cream and a drizzle of honey to her cup, stirred the mixture and leaned back, holding the mug. So this is what it's like, being a woman grown. I make my own tea, kill my own puppies, and have this awful thing happen to me every month. Something in the statement made me want to smile, but my mouth felt frozen. It's not so awful. Church women aren't allowed to have relations with the men during this time. They aren't allowed to work in the greenhouse or garden or with the animals. I think this is the time each month that church women get to sit quiet, to read books, to meditate and have time to be introspective. Edith called it a curse. Not all our sisters or friends are very smart. Sometimes even the best women can be kind of stupid. So what are we? That was Mud, cutting to the chase, demanding answers. I don't know. Not exactly. I do know that we can claim land with our blood, maybe even accidentally, and that when we do, we become responsible for it. We become its caretakers. And you bled on the vampire tree. Ewan's claimed it. And deserted it, I acknowledged. I knew on some deep-down level that my desertion had caused the tree to mutate. That fact left me mentally wringing my hands with guilt. My neglect had killed a puppy today, taken back to its most basic beginnings. I had killed Rex. To say that I didn't know what claiming it might mean and didn't know that deserting it would make it bloodthirsty is no excuse. We can make land healthy and fecund. We can make it grow crops, or seems like we can make it spit out weeds and thorns. We do that by communing with it, and by bleeding on it, Little drops. That's how we claim it. Gross. The bleeding part. I get the talking to trees part. I've been talking to plants since I was in diapers, so what are we? I don't know. A friend told me I was Yenehi, which is sort of like a fae. At her blank look, I said, like a fairy. She looked down at herself. Too big. Ain't got no wings. Can't fly. I laughed, the sound unexpected and stuttering. Good point. I did some more research, but I still didn't find us. I guess I need to expand my search parameters. Find out what we are. Search parameters. Townie talk. And when you learn what's what, you'll tell me, right? I nodded my head and cradled the lemon ginger tea, letting it soothe me. Soon as I know, I'll tell you. So how am I gonna get land? And how am I gonna not get courted in 2 years and married in 4? And how am I gonna be safe? I want land. It don't have to be as good as soul wood. I can make it grow if and I work at it right. I want a place of my own. No husband and no children. You're too young to know if you really want children or not. Church women don't care what I want. They decide, and the women folk follow, all excepting you. And I want a real life with the land. I'm still trying to make up my mind about youngins, and I'm nearly 24 years old. Okay, I'll decide if I want a man and babies after I'm 24. I smiled. We both sipped. Why ain't you got no Christmas tree? I topped up our cups. Well, sister mine, I've had no time to think about Christmas. Soon, though. You can tell me when, and I'll help you. Deal. The three mouser cats raced down the stairs and leaped on the couch to curl on top of us and around us. The house warmed, and it occurred to me that maybe Mud could live here, with me, and that maybe I could give her a small part of my land, like a land dowry, or something, if Daddy would ever let her move in with me. You know, you ain't got green leaves growing out of your fingers. I held out my hand, fingers splayed. Yep. Am I gonna grow green leaves? I have no idea, sister mine. I reckon we'll figure it out as we go then. I reckon, I agreed. Ideas and possibilities racing around in my brain like bumper cars, all filled with excitement and delight, slamming into concern and fear. All the things that could go wrong. All the things that I might have to reveal to my family. The tree I had to corral and harness and direct. Brother Ephraim to kill. Again. And all that very soon. My time with Mud was short, but I let her help me clip the foliage off my neck and away from my fingernails. She seemed to find it amusing and giggled every time a leaf went flying. The laughter did us both good, but I was going to be late to work, and so I cut it short, gathering up my gear and herding the cats onto the back porch. Then I drove my sister back to the church compound, let her out, and watched her go inside the Nicholson house. Not wanting to do it, but knowing I had to, I drove to the tree, parked and got out, wrapping my coat tightly about me, shoving my hands deep into my pockets. The sun was setting, casting a red glow on the once-upon-a-time oak and dark shadows leaning long behind it. The tree was no longer young and vibrant and full of life. It had dark, thick bark and abundant, swollen leaves. Too thick and pliable to be a live oak or a deciduous tree. The leaves were more like the foliage of a succulent, with scarlet-lined veins that, when broken, dripped a red substance, viscous as blood, gooey and oily. The tree had grown wildly since I had used it to heal me. It now had the girth of an old-growth tree, bigger than 5 men holding hands could reach around, with branches that coiled and curled. Vines sprouted from the jointure of limbs and trunk, each covered with needle-like thorns, At the base lay the remains of a cement block wall, tumbled and fallen in shattered heaps, the wall the churchmen had constructed with the hope of keeping the tree confined. They had also tried chainsaws, fire, herbicides, dynamite, and a bulldozer, which the tree had eaten. It was entombed inside the mass of leaves and vines and branches somewhere, the huge behemoth buried. This one tree looked like the forest of a child's fairy tale, one capable of burying a kingdom. Around its base, at the wide drip line, roots had sprouted up new growth. It looked as if the tree was trying to grow an enchanted, or cursed, forest.
You figured out a way to kill that thing?
I didn't turn around at the sound of my brother's voice. Hey, Sam. My last suggestion didn't work, I guess.
Couldn't get close enough to cut it or blow it up. Thought about throwing a stick of TNT on it and hoping for the best, but I was afraid it might throw it back at us.
I breathed out a laugh, a sound a were-leopard might make, chuffing. Tilted my head to Sam. He was standing to my left at the back of the truck. Like me, he was dressed in winter layers, his hands in his pockets. A hand crocheted toboggan in Mama's favorite blues was on his head. With each breath, he blew a cloud of vapor.
What is it now?
I shook my head, watching him in my peripheral vision. I need to do some thinking, brother mine, on the vampire tree, on a lot of things. When I got something to say or do, I'll let you know. Sam pressed his fists deeply into his pockets, his heavy jacket pulling down.
When that time comes, am I going to have to hold off the pitchforks and kerosene to keep some of the church folk from burning you at the stake?
Would you protect me, Sam?
Yes.
I nodded at the simple statement. Why did you set Benjamin on me? Why did you surprise me like that?
My brother shrugged. You've been gone a long time. But I still miss you, Nellie. I miss your spirit and your smart mouth. I miss the way you don't let nothing and no one stop you from doing the right thing, even if you and suffer for it. Daddy, he's been fighting the mamas for months about going to the surgeon. You and stomped him, and now he's got an appointment.
The church speak faded as he spoke. The family needs you. The church needs you. We need you to lead us into the 21st century, into the future. It's that or die. When I said nothing, he added,
church membership numbers were highest in 1954, at well over 1,200. Now church rolls stand at 614, with women leaving the church all the time. The church is dying.
I thought about that. Thought about the cycle of life and death, understood that all trees die eventually, all forests. So do all civilizations, all organizations, and all churches. Maybe it was time for God's cloud to die, be chopped up and fed into the fire of some new church. I'll let you know about the tree when I figure things out. Leaving my brother staring at the mutated oak, I walked back to my truck and drove away, thinking that my brother was a hunter, and the hunter in him had baited a trap well with Ben Aiden, and with the plea to bring the church into the 21st century. He meant everything he'd said, in the best way possible, but he was still reasoning like a churchman. On the way out, I slowed and studied the place where I had told the vampire tree to move, the place where I had dropped my blood to encourage it to move. All along the fence were small growths, with dark bark and heavy, reddish-tipped, engorged leaves. Some of the growths had put out vines that had begun to curl into the hurricane fencing. I had a feeling that they would grow fast, winter or no. I had made a bad mistake asking them to grow here. Probably had made several more mistakes. I had to decide how to fix them all. Probably like yesterday. I pulled up at Sci-Led headquarters on Alameda Avenue,
a newish road on newly developed land off Highway 62. It was three stories of government building ugly, with the two top levels set aside for Psi-Led, and for an eventual Psi-CSI whenever the government got around to fully funding the agency. The bottom floor was Yoshi's Deli and Coffee's On, and I stopped for coffee. As I entered, the girl behind the counter smiled at me and said, "The usual?" "Oh, yes, please." I watched her making me a caramel cappuccino and understood that I had, at some point in the last few weeks and months, gone through a rite of passage without even realizing it. The usual. I had a usual coffee at a coffee house. Unlike God's cloud of glory, I had entered the 21st century. I was a modern-day woman. Maybe even a city girl. Knowing that didn't help much, but it did show that things could change. My heart heavy and my mind full of thoughts that writhed like snakes, I carried my gear and coffee inside and up the stairs. I had a feeling that the EOD debriefing was going to be long and tedious. Jojo said, "Financial update. Like everyone else with assets, the Tolliver family has money invested in the Tennessee Valley Authority. They also are heavily invested in four local small industries that make parts for weapons manufacturing companies, a video PR talent agency that handles the careers of several Tennessee sports icons, and three big country singers, and a medical corporation called DNA Keys." She glanced up from her tablet. Which is where it gets a little interesting. She looked back at her screen, her earrings swinging. "Social media conspiracy nuts suggest that DNA Keys is holding a vampire and wolves, or werewolves, prisoner on the premises, and is doing animal experimentation that sounds like something out of a horror movie. Multiple social media sites have shared the accusations, specifying internal sources for the charges. I'm working to track down the sources so we can interview them. The claims got so bad, the company asked the Cook County Sheriff's Department to take a walk through the facilities 8 months past. The investigators discovered no paranormal sentient beings. The detective I spoke with suggested that the conspiracy stuff could be kids or smear tactics from a political or business enemy. But basically, he said no crimes were currently taking place on site. Probably a waste of time, but send the address to ourselves," Rick said. "Oakham and I can check it out tonight." He meant in cat form. I glanced at the corner of my laptop screen as we all worked through reports and files and updated everything pertinent, checking the phase of the moon on the little icon there. The full moon was only days away. I looked up at Jojo, and her tight lips indicated that she knew why the cat boys wanted to go skulking around in cat form. Things always got kind of crazy around Psi-Led in the 9 days of the moon. There was a quote about moon tides for were creatures, though I had no idea who had said it originally. It was part of were lore. "The urge to shift and to hunt waxes strong 3 days out, abides the 3 days of, and wanes 3 days after. 9 nights of pleasure and 9 days of hell." We were getting close to the craziness. Rick continued, "The sheriff was invited in. We haven't been, and we don't have probable cause to get a warrant. But we can get close enough to get a good sniff, just to rule out wares and vamps." "Uh-huh," Jojo said, typing furiously. "If the sheriff missed something and you get close enough for werewolves to catch your scent, things could get dicey. I respectfully suggest that you put this plan of action on the back burner, boss." Rick tilted his head in a gesture that said, "I hear you, and I'm ignoring you. Psi-Led's mandate is any and all crimes committed by, perpetrated on, or related to paranormal creatures. We'll go in downwind." Tandy, who had been awfully silent, said, "We know that several werewolves were never captured after that recent were-teen outbreak in Asheville. Law enforcement has been working under the assumption that not all the infected persons were caught. If you go in downwind and stay several hundred yards away, you should be okay.
However, it might be smarter to send in an RVAC. And safer.
Jojo raised her eyebrows at Tandy, shooting him a look I couldn't interpret. But then the two were probably in a sexual relationship, hiding it from Rick, in opposition to Cy-Led standard, but not enforced, protocol, and outside of proper marriage. Proper marriage. There was a holdover from the church teachings of my youth. These days people didn't get married to have sex. They just went ahead and did it. And in the church, they married only to have sex. In the past, with underage girls, it was evil. If I dated Oakham, I'd be in the same situation as Tandy and Joe. Now that I was out of spook school, dating a co-worker wasn't exactly forbidden, but it wasn't smart either. Rick said,
"Nell, I want you to go back again, to the Holloway home, to Justin Tolliver's burned house, and then to the senator's home. I want you to read the earth for two reasons. One, to specifically search for paranormal energies other than the assassin who burns things. All we have is the anomalous reading on the psi-meter 2.0 and the scorching or chemical burns to the land. And there isn't anything in the histories or mythos that pinpoints a creature who does that. We need more to go on. Read deeper. Find us something to work with."
I didn't sigh, but I wanted to. Being a paranormal investigator might sound exciting on the surface, but it really wasn't. It was a lot of repetition, of going over the same evidentiary ground, literally in my case, over and over again. It was paperwork, rereading paperwork, comparing paperwork, and a whole lot of brainstorming and interviews. I was getting tired of going over the same ground. But that gift was why I was part of Cy-Led. Rather than share my litany of complaints, I repeated, "Other paranormals. Like what? Witches? Vampires? Wares?
Anything. Any magical signature that doesn't belong. And then you pull night shift on the senator's grounds."
"Okay. If we're done, then I'm out of here." At Rick's nod, I grabbed my bags, taking off for my trusty, rusty truck. I ran a few errands and then started my investigation with Justin and Sonia Tolliver's burned home, where the security guards and one lone FBI agent, not my cousin, gave me access to the grounds. It was impossible to smell anything other than the ruined house, stale water, and the heavily scorched lawn. But the trail of the assassin was clear and unquestionable. Brown and burned trails through the grass. The guards had seen nothing and no one since the fire, except for scaring off some kids out exploring with beer the night before. They had raced off before the guards could get a vehicle tag. Not that the uniforms had tried very hard to catch a few drunk kids. I did a quick read on the dead grass and on the living lawn, with the psi-meter 2.0 and with hand in dirt, and texted my impressions to Jojo. I found nothing new. No wares, no witches, no vampires, no unexpected paranormal signatures. Feeling the night and the long guard duty ahead, I drove to the Holloway's house. The ruined windows had been replaced, the crime scene tape was gone, and a neat for sale sign was out front. Not that I blamed the family for moving. Even without putting hands in soil, I could tell that the ground around the repaired house was dead along the trail used by the assassin. Dead under the window where he stood to fire the gun. Dead through the path to the road in back. The only advantage to an additional read was the ability and opportunity to pinpoint exactly where the shooter left the land for the road, and where he disappeared. That and the fact that here, where the overriding stench of house fire was not present, the dead grass and plants smelled very slightly scorched, more certainly a chemical burn rather than a flame burn. The smell was odd, but not definitive of species origin. Not anything I could pinpoint from spook school class, paranormal, physiology 101, or even 202. Nothing recognizable. And the psi-meter read baseline normal. I made a mental note to get a cat nose out here to sniff around.
To avoid comments from the lone guard patrolling the grounds, I went to the edge of the lawn at the back of the property near the stand of trees, close enough to see the dead sapling in the security lights. I placed my old pink blanket, folded, on the ground, then sat and stuck my fingers directly into the dirt at the base of an undamaged tree. I sank my consciousness lightly into the ground, where I found maggots. Instantly, they crawled and wiggled up my fingers to my wrists. I yanked my fingers out, shot to my feet, and danced away. My breath came fast. Tingles ran up and down my whole body. My stomach roiled, and I thought I might gag. My most fearsome maggot memory squelched under my bare foot again, as intense as the day it had happened, when I stepped into that dead possum covered with maggots. They slimed onto my bare foot and wriggled. I had screamed and screamed. The only other maggoty memories were vampiric in nature. Standing a good 10 feet away, I forced calm into myself with some deep breathing exercises, and then forced myself to pick up my pink blanket and carry it back to the C-10. I dropped the blanket into the back and sat in the cab, the heater on high, cleaning my hands with baby wipes, which I had discovered were essential to any investigation. Though the baby scent fragrance was awful, it did help to clear my head. Rick had sent me here to check for paranormal presences. I had found one. But what if it wasn't from a bad guy, the shooter? When I was less panicked, I found Yummy in my contacts and punched call. She answered with, "Well, if it isn't Maggoty." "More than you know," I thought. "I want to know what you or one of your pals has been doing at the Holloway house, hiding in the edge of the woods." There was a hard silence, and I thought my cell might have dropped the call. I wanted to say, "Hello?" But I needed to appear strong, and that one interrogative might ruin things. After a good few Mississippis, Yummy said,
"You are able to detect that a Mithrin has been to that house?"
"Yeah, walking the edge of the property, standing long enough in one spot for me to sense it. You want to tell me what you folks have been up to out here?" Yummy blew out a breath, one I know she didn't need, and so it was either muscle memory, emotion, or for effect.
"I policed the grounds last night, searching for the attacker, trying to sniff out if it was a Mithrin."
"And what did you smell?"
"The attacker smells neither like Mithrin nor like cattle," she said, her words precise.
It took a moment for me to understand that she meant the shooter didn't smell like a vampire or human. Vampires drank humans, so they ended up thinking of them as food sources and pets, hence the cattle term. It was as insulting as my maggot term. I decided to ignore it. "Why do you keep asking, worrying, if the shooter is a vampire?" I heard a soft, uneven tapping on Yummy's end, like a fingernail or pen against a hard surface, as if she was thinking. She sighed again, definitely for effect.
"A small group of Europeans carried out an attack against the master of the city of New Orleans. There's been a retaliatory challenge to the European emperor, Titus Flavius Vespasianus, a challenge of sangre duelo."
That wasn't news, nor was it surprising that she should know so much. The surprise came because she shared it so freely. "I'm aware of that. Go on. There's gonna be a fight."
"We await the schedule. If Leo Pelissier loses, then all the Mithrins within the borders of the United States and Canada are at risk of extermination."
That bit was news to me, but Yummy was on a roll, so I let her talk.
"There have been whispers that others of the Europeans came ashore during the attack and found shelter and safety. Rumors that they called those they sired or bound. Mithrins have gone missing."
"Some of yours?" Yummy didn't reply to that one. "And you think they might come after you and Ming of Glass? To harm or kill?"
"It's not an impossibility."
I debated telling Yummy what we knew about the arson and the shooter. Vamps were flammable, much more so than humans, so the likelihood of the attacker being vampish was not very high. However, she had told me about the situation in New Orleans and her fears for the Knoxville area. Rick would call it quid pro quo. For your ears only. Would it help if I told you without question that the attacker is not a vampire?
You're so certain.
Yep. There's no maggots at any of the sites except yours. Yummy gave a low, mocking laugh. I'm not sure if I'm happy at the information or insulted at the comparison. Whatever it is, he, she, or it burned the foliage everywhere he moved with what reads like a chemical burn. You ever hear of a creature able to do that? No. Chemicals strong enough to kill foliage might damage a Mithrin's flesh. I have access to Ming's records. I can do a search. Couldn't hurt. Might help. If we knew what it was, we might know where to search. Might know when to expect another attack. If I find something pertinent, I will call. I almost said thank you, but that might put me in her debt. I settled on, any information you might provide could prove useful. Yummy laughed again, her tone telling me that she knew exactly why I had phrased it that way, and ended the call. I wrote a report on my laptop and sent it in. If I failed to mention Yummy and her information about the Mithrins, well, I could consider the vampire a confidential source because nothing she'd said impacted the case at this time. I felt a little guilty, since Rick had told us to share anything about paranormals, but I squished the guilt down, and then ignored the guilt that came from ignoring guilt. Satisfied, I put the truck in drive and motored on over to my assignment for the night, at the home of Senator Abrams Tolliver. I read the earth there, too, and it told me nothing it hadn't before, except that no maggoty vampire had been stalking the premises. The investigation went on all night, and I kept up with it on my government-issued encrypted cell phone, reading files and reports, in between walking rounds with the feds and the Secret Service, while on dinner break, sitting in the truck with the heater roaring and a cup of coffee steaming on the dash, I ate a sandwich I had picked up at a supermarket and read deeper into incoming reports. Arson had been confirmed at Justin Tolliver's house, though the type of accelerant had yet to be determined. Rick checked out the paranormal sense and told me things smelled odd, but not definable or species-specific. My reading of the land notwithstanding, the attacker had been deemed possibly paranormal, the possibly keeping Psy-Led from assuming charge of the case. Based on the possibility, however, Psy-Led would have a bigger investigatory role. Psy-Led and the FBI were still operating under the auspices of the Secret Service, and for now, we had access to files not compiled by us. Cooperation still taking place. At least one of the Tolliver family was also deemed likely a paranormal. Justin's wife, Sonia, had been outed, though none of the Tollivers knew it yet. Nor did the feds, or the Secret Service. Sol was holding that information close to the vest for now, since Sonia wasn't a suspect. Psy-Led's focus had currently shifted to the research facility, DNA Keys, which seemed like the wrong way to go to me, because interest in the facility was based on the rumored presence of paras in captivity, not on physical, direct, or circumstantial evidence. But my opposition to DNA Keys as an investigatory focus was a gut feeling, based on precisely nothing. I didn't include that in my comments on the report. I reopened my notes for tonight's readings, and into the comments space I typed, "Ground at Holloway's and Justin and Sonia Tolliver's feels wrong. Damage is beneath the surface, not on top, as it would be if chemical or physical agents had burned the ground and plants. This has nothing to do with vampires or were-creatures." I thought about adding the words "in my opinion," but that urge was church think left over from my upbringings as a woman in God's cloud. My readings were not opinions. They were fact. So I hit enter and read on. Jojo had discovered that there was a fire at DNA Keys 15 months past, one answered by the East Tennessee Rural Metro Fire Department. That was when the tales of the creatures imprisoned there began to surface, probably gossip spread by the responders. I doubted that the paid firefighting employees would chatter, but maybe a volunteer had gossiped. Surely Rural Metro had a roster of volunteers. Since the forest fires of 2016, most rural departments had a list they kept on hand. I texted the office and asked for someone to obtain a roster of volunteers at the stations that had answered the fire call at DNA Keys. Tandy texted back that Jojo had already acquired it. I didn't ask if it was obtained legally, or if she had found a back door and acquired it on her own. Hacking was illegal, but so easy, according to our IT specialist. Tandy sent me the list, and on it, I found two names I knew. Thaddeus Rankin Sr. and Thaddeus Rankin Jr., or Thad and Deuce, father and son, who had put in the windows on my house. Volunteer firefighting sounded exactly like something the two would do. I texted HQ that I would be stopping by the Rankins' place of business as soon as my schedule permitted. Tandy texted back that I could leave the night shift in the hands of Alt Security and the other government guards. With Sci-Led now in an improved investigatory position, my talents could be best used elsewhere, and Sol wanted an initial interview with the Rankins tomorrow. Meantime, she had another job for me. I walked the grounds again and said goodbye to the guards before heading back to HQ, to prep and organize for a nighttime op. Chapter 8. It was the operation I thought to be foolish. Rick and Oakham were going to approach the DNA Keys research facility and scope out the place with cat eyes from tree limb level. The whole idea was stupid, but a probie couldn't say it to the SAC or to the man who had asked her to dinner. Rick finished the op instructions with the words, "Nell, you're to pull back up, manage comms, and be an extra ear. Here, try these." He held out a set of binoculars attached to a strap system shaped to fit a human head. Rick was holding up the unit's brand new low-light IR vision binoculars. "You'll be the first to use it." My heart did a funny little leap. A probie never got to be first on anything good. Last week, we had all watched the how-to video for the expensive headgear, which had taken a big chunk out of the remaining budget for the year. The goggles, made with a redundant dual-tube design that could withstand all kinds of weather changes and temps, had an automatic brightness control, bright light shut-off circuitry, and a spotlight floodlight built-in IR illuminator. The binocular-shaped gadget would allow me to see clearly even in areas with no ambient light, like the middle of nowhere in the middle of the night. I gave Rick a grin suitable for him giving me a fully equipped greenhouse, took the contraption, and started to put it on. He stopped me with a raised hand, amusement in his dark eyes. "Night vision, remember? Go to the locker room, kill the lights, and adjust it to fit." I had to change anyway, and grabbed both my small go-bag and my large four-day go-bag on the way to the locker room, where I adjusted the straps and the eyepieces and familiarized myself with the location of the small knob that turned from off to on to IR. According to the video I had watched, the night vision goggles were pretty much idiot-proof. Satisfied, I tucked them into my small go-bag and changed clothes. Sci-Led provided desert night camo like the military used, and the cost had come out of my pocket, but I'd never worn the clothing, and Rick hadn't told me I had to wear it tonight. I dressed in blue jeans, layered dark gray and charcoal patterned T-shirts, and my hooded winter coat with field boots. All black is visible in low to no light, and the paler clothes would give me some light protection out in the middle of nowhere. The jeans would protect my body and save my nicer work clothes should I have to hike in somewhere. I checked my weapons, making sure I had two extra magazines, one filled with hollow point rounds, one with silver plating, just in case.
Under the coat, I put on the shoulder holster rig instead of the lower spine holster, which was less than comfortable while driving in the truck. Back in the break room, I ate a quick slice of pizza left over from someone's supper. I wasn't stealing. It was on the fridge shelf marked all. I refilled my insulated coffee mug, and when I heard Rick and Oakham departing, followed them down the stairs to the street. It was 2 a.m., and the guys had been awake for close to 20 hours. They were snapping at each other the way cats would if cats could talk.
"You'll follow my lead up to the..."
"Why should I follow your lead, Hoss? I've been a werecat longer than you have. I've actually hunted wild hogs, and those babies have tusks this long." Oakham held out both hands a ways apart. I let the outer door close behind me and didn't look up to see his expression.
"They can rip open a predator's gut in a heartbeat. You, my kidding friend, are the proby here. You have hunted exactly 2 full moons and brought down exactly 4 deer. Sweet little Bambies. With help from me, let me remind you. I should take point."
From nowhere, a Grindolo leaped onto Oakham's back, her neon green coat looking yellowish in the outside lights.
"Ow!"
Oakham said, grabbing her and tossing her to Rick as they walked. The SAC caught her in midair and placed her on his shoulders without missing a step. He blew out a breath in a cloud and cocked his head cat-like. His eyes were glowing green in the parking lot security lights. The shadows of the men lengthened and shortened as they walked. I followed. When Rick spoke, it wasn't to the Grindy, which he petted almost in a reflex, but to Oakham.
"I'm a black were-leopard. My melanistic coat is perfect for night hunting. Your spotted one is more visible. I'm more sneaky."
Oakham opened the driver's door of his fancy car.
"When you're in cat form, you're thinking like a cat in the wild, not like a human. And your cat's out of control. Not a good thing on an op."
"I'm SAC." Rick got in the passenger side, tossing the Grindy to the dash.
"Which means jack nothing, Hoss. I'm better qualified, and you know it."
"We have protocol."
The car doors closed. The engine roared, and they drove away, leaving me standing there alone in the parking lot. I put both fists on my hips and huffed in disgust, watching their taillights, my small go-bag over my shoulder. I turned and waved at the very obvious security camera over the door to HQ, knowing that Tandy had seen the entire exchange. Upstairs, the lights in the office blinked off and back on. The fact that I had been abandoned had been acknowledged. Tandy was probably all worried about me. If it had been JoJo, she would have been laughing so hard she'd snort coffee. I had seen that happen. Had to hurt. I got in my truck, punched the address into my cellular GPS, and pulled into the street. I had driven a mile when my cell rang. It was Oakham. I scowled at the cell and let it go to voicemail. Twice. On the third try, I punched accept and said, "What?"
"Nell Sugar, where are you?"
Oakham sounded properly quiet and deferential.
"We left you in the parking lot.
I'm sorry." An apology went a long way to fixing things, but I had been raised with men who treated women with less respect than they did other men. "Yes," I said, "you did." And I got in my truck and I turned it on and I am driving, alone. I am perfectly capable of arriving at the correct GPS on this, my first level 2 nighttime op. I will see you there. I hit end. JoJo and T-Lane would both say I was being bitchy. And then they'd high-five me and say, "Give 'em hell, girl." A woman had to stand up to men, even in this new modern world. Women always did, and never more so than with alpha males who seemed to have a cat rivalry of some sort going on. I just hadn't thought it would be Oakham who made me defend myself this time. Tears prickled my eyes, and ruthlessly I squashed them. That was stupid. I would not cry because men acted in human character and in cat character. I took a right and headed toward Millertown Pike and then Rutledge Pike, also known as Highway 11 West. As I drove, I thought about Benjamin,
and what would have happened had he been in Oakham's place. He'd have asked me to bring him a cup of coffee and maybe have a good dinner waiting for him when he got back. The likelihood of him even thinking about me going on any mission was low to none. A woman's presence on such a mission would have been considered valueless. Oakham just forgot about me. Or his cat did. Man, dang them all. My hands tightened on the wheel and I followed the cell phone's directions out of Knoxville. DNA Keys' research facility was out of town down a narrow, privately maintained paved road on the far side of House Mountain State Natural Area. There were no streetlights this far out of town and no visible security measures, but there was also no gated entrance. So the lack of obvious security measures was likely occult, not meaning paranormal, meaning hidden. Oakham's fancy car, a 2015 Ford Mustang two-door fastback GT with all the bells and whistles, was parked in the dark off the side of the road and down a little used driveway with an overgrown for sale sign in the weeds, about a mile from the turnoff to the facility. I pulled in behind it, turned off the engine and the lights, and closed my eyes, letting them adapt to night vision. As I waited, I set my comms earbud in my ear, adjusted the mic, and hooked the comms system at my waistband. When my vision was more attuned to the night, I got out, carrying my flash, which I didn't turn on, and walked around the fancy car. The men were nowhere to be seen, which meant they were changing shape or were already hunting. They hadn't been that far ahead of me, so I was betting on shape-shifting somewhere out in the dark. I sniffed and listened to the night, taking in the smells and the sounds, a little exhaust, my coffee, something musky, the were-leopards, most likely. I heard no sounds except what might be the far-off hum of cars. In the distance were city lights. Closer were security lights, which I assumed would be DNA Keys's. I returned to my truck and sat, engine and lights still off, in the growing cold, sipping coffee from my insulated mug, strong and black. The caffeine was a drug, too bitter to be a frou-frou drink, too strong to be my regular. I waited, my senses straining in the dark, needing my ruddy middle, literally putting my fingers on my non-humanness. The cold seeped into me, and I pulled the pink blanket over me. I had rescued it from the truck bed, and it no longer felt like maggots. If this had been Soulwood, I could have put my hands in the earth and discovered the cat's location easily. Out here, so far from home, the land wouldn't even know I was alive. Especially in the dormant season. Trying to read the land would be harder. A lot harder. And I'd grow leaves that I would then have to prune. I should have brought me a good book. The first indication that the men had shifted was a thump that rocked the truck and Oakham's cat face pressed against the windshield, staring at me, lips pulled back, showing me his fangs. He hissed. My only reaction was to grip my cup so hard I feared I might bend the metal handle. I wanted to jump or squeal or both, which I presumed he had intended. Oakham's cat was mischievous. I narrowed my eyes at him, knowing he could see me clearly in the dark. His lips lowered to cover his teeth, and he stared at me, white whiskers touching the windshield. Oakham was a pretty cat, all gold and dark brown. His golden eyes lined with black like an Egyptian king's with coal. Deliberately, I sipped my coffee and stared back at him, giving as good as I got, maybe better. He snorted, blowing twin spots of condensation on the glass. He lay down, belly on the warm hood, his huge, dappled body vanishing in the night, his face close to the glass. He didn't shift his gaze away. I was being hunted. I scowled at the cat and set my coffee in the mug holder, pulled on the headgear, drew my service weapon, and set it on the dash. Oakham now appeared as a greenish-spotted killer, haunches and tail hanging off the truck. "Take that, you dang old cat," I muttered. Oakham blinked, looked at the gun on the dash, at me, and turned away, giving me the back of his head. He flopped his head down flat on the hood. In cat speak, it was a complete dismissal and a refusal to consider me anything but a bore, and certainly not a threat. It made me want to laugh, or shoot him, or both, but I refrained. "Tit for tat," I said, knowing he could hear me through the windows. "Don't push it, pussycat." Oakham chuffed and started purring. I could feel the vibration through the truck body. He was having fun. The Grindolo joined him and started grooming Oakham's fur, her long, improbable steel claws combing and probably trimming as she worked. About 10 minutes later, there was a second thump, and a big black cat joined him, a comms unit strapped around his neck, but otherwise hard to see in the night. My hood bowed, so I tapped on the window and waved them away. They ignored me. I tapped my mic to turn on the recorder and said, "Night op." I gave the date and the location by address and GPS coordinates. Time is 3:26 a.m. Oakham and Rick LaFleur at recon. Nell Ingram is backup. Without glancing my way, Rick nudged Oakham. The two cats, with the Grindy riding on Oakham's back, slid to the ground and vanished, leaving the truck rocking and the hood returning to normal. Dang cats. I adjusted the mic into a more comfortable position and holstered my weapon, drank down most of the coffee. When the cold started to creep in, I got out of the truck, crossed the road to a tree I had seen when I reconnoitered Oakham's car, and sat on the low branch. I adjusted the fit and the gear until I could see and hear and talk with ease, and played with the headgear, switching back and forth from IR to low light. I identified a small herd of deer moving along the hillside, their bodies reddish on IR, heated against the colder earth, and when I flipped the nod to low light, greenish. Later, two large dogs raced down the road, well-fed and enjoying a night of freedom, possibly escapees from chains or small pens, from the way they played and loped and chased each other. They never saw or smelled the deer. Or me. An owl flowed over the ground, silent as death, and dropped on a rabbit. Its squeal of pain and fear was quickly cut off as the owl carried it to a branch and started eating. Feral cats hunted, small spots of color depending on which visual spectrum I used. Minutes passed. The excitement of playing with the new night oculars wore thin. The cold deepened. I prepared to be frozen and bored. One thing the long wait gave me was time to think. And I realized that being left in HQ's parking lot wasn't a gender thing. It was totally a cat thing. If Tandy had been there back up, he would have been left standing there, too. As slats went, it was small, and only seemed big to me because, as T. Lane would say, it had pushed my buttons. 90 minutes after the cats departed, the sun was starting to gray the eastern sky and low clouds were dropping, fog rolling down the hillside like an avalanche, and along the road like a vaporous flood. A car rolled past, then another, heading the other way. A school bus rumbled and squeaked on a parallel road beyond the trees. The human world was starting to wake up and head to work and school. We needed to be out of here. I tapped the mic 3 times, taps Rick would be able to hear even with the comms hanging around his neck. The tap stood for LaFleur, report back to origination and insert point, ASAP. It was a reminder that they needed to become human again, that there was work to do. I 3-tapped again. There was no reply because Rick had turned off his mic, and because his cat didn't have opposable thumbs to turn it back on. And because his cat didn't speak English. There were a lot of reasons why he didn't respond, most of them amusing. Moments later on the hillside, I caught a hint of movement, red in the infrared range. 2 slinky cat shapes were working their way down toward the road, strides lazy, in no hurry. I made my way to my truck and started the engine,
waiting for them to shift back. I wanted to leave them as they had left me. But wares in the midst of shifting were vulnerable, and I knew better. But that didn't mean I had to wait till they got dressed. The moment I saw a human shape in the low-light goggles, still naked and steaming in a greenish haze, I drove off, stopping once for fresh bakery bread and a bear claw that tempted me like a sweet devil. The claw was greasy, nowhere near as good as Mama's, and I was able to eat only part of it. But the to-go coffee was surprisingly tasty, much better than the burned sludge I expected. I picked up a second coffee, my regular in the coffee shop, along with an egg and bacon on flatbread, which was wonderful. Upstairs, I checked in with HQ, where Tandy was turning everything over to JoJo, who had gotten up from a nap in the back room. T-Lane was typing up a report so fast the keys clacking sounded like castanets. Sol was in the break room making coffee, looking gorgeous and curvy and sophisticated, her teal and aqua gauzy skirts moving with the air from the heater vents, or from her magic. Shape-shifting magic was different for each shifter species, and our concierge magic was the least understood of all. I was eating and inputting my report when Rick and Oakham came in. Rick went to his office. Oakham stopped at my cubicle, and I could see him reflected in the window where my plants grew, his body dark and indistinct against the rising sun. "Nail sugar?" he asked, sounding very Texan, the way he often did after a shift to his cat. I hit enter and saved my report, picked up my coffee and spun in my chair to face him. His blondish hair hung long. His beard was a post-shift two-day growth and scruffy. His eyes were more than human golden. He was wearing jeans low on his hips, and his T-shirt was faded and too tight, showing abs and biceps and deltoids. His arms were up, hands on the cubicle walls, balanced.
"You still mad? We shouldn't have left you."
"Not mad. Actually, it kind of makes me feel all warm and fuzzy inside." His eyebrows lifted, wrinkling his forehead in confusion. "Makes me feel like I'm really and truly part of Unit 18, I explained.
"I'm not following you, Nail Sugar."
If I'd been T-Lane or Tandy or JoJo, you'd still have forgotten me. You were being cats, already focused on the hunt. It's the humans and witches and empaths' job to look after the werecats when you get focused on werecat issues. So forgetting me made me one of the team. You didn't think you needed to babysit the probie or the woman. I apologize for hanging up on you. I hadn't thought it through at the time.
"Damn, woman."
Oakham looked half impressed, half fearful.
"Just when I think I got you figured out, you go and do something unexpected. So you ain't gonna be getting us back for forgetting you?"
"Oh, there'll be payback." I sipped and spun back to my laptop. "That's Unit 18's way." Oakham snorted a laugh, all cat, a little intrigued, and I realized that I had maybe just flirted with the cat man. A plant woman flirting with a were-leopard. I felt a blush race up my throat into my face. JoJo yelled down the hallway, "Gather round! Report!" I picked up my laptop and stood, taking one step toward the hallway, stopped in a sudden jerk. Oakham hadn't moved. I was too close. I wanted to step back, but that would have been weak. I wanted to bull my way through him, but that would have been dangerous. I wanted to cover my chest with the laptop. Weak. Wanted to hit him with the laptop. Dangerous. I couldn't think of anything to do that would be neither weak nor dangerous. I raised my head and met his eyes, golden and glowing cat eyes. Yeah. Dangerous.
"Cat boy," JoJo yelled again. "Get your butt in here and stop scaring the probie."
"Probie ain't scared," Oakham growled.
"Probie ain't never scared."
I thought that was the nicest compliment I had ever been given. A complete untruth, but nice that he would think I was brave when I was more often a worried, panicked rabbit,
like the one eaten by the owl only hours past. I smiled, ducked my head, and pushed Oakham out of the way, using my laptop to keep from touching him with my whole hand, though I felt his wear warmth on the backs of my knuckles. He resisted for just a moment, and I pushed harder. He gave way, and I walked past him, head high, laptop holding.